Drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. Now, this is one of the biggest commitments most people will make in their lives. Yep, getting married. But while approximately 113,000 Australians get hitched every year, one in three marriages are still ending in divorce. And this comes with a huge emotional and, of course, economic cost as well. Amanda Lambros is a clinical fellow at the Curtin University in Western Australia and a relationships counsellor. And Professor Laurie Brown is director of the National Centre for Social and Economic Modelling at the University of Canberra. Hi to both of you.
Hi, hello, Patricia. How's it going?
Good. Amanda, let's start with you. Is it true that we saw a spate of divorces taking place last month, like that in January, typically lots of couples file for divorce?
A lot of couples file for a divorce towards the end of a year, so December and the start of a new year. And really, if you think about it, if you take on the idea of Christmas holidays or holiday season preparation, you can kind of understand why.
Yeah, it's not entirely surprising, is it? Is it also that it's the time you spend in a really kind of intensive period with your partner, and some people just go, nah, not into it anymore?
Well, it's typically the one time of year that you're actually spending more than 8 hours a day with your partner, and also family and friends and stuff like that, and other people who have kind of impact on the relationship.
We used to talk about the 7-year itch, like it was a thing. There's movies made, you know, it's a movie called The 7-Year Itch. Is it still happening? Is that the time frame where people rethink the relationship?
I don't necessarily see people around the 7-year itch, but we're definitely finding that getting to 10 years is quite difficult. Once you've surpassed 10 years, it's like getting to 20 years then becomes difficult.
So if you can make it to 10...
then you're doing pretty good.
Yeah, well, full stop. And then, what, you're more likely to make it to 20? How does it work then?
Yes. So if you've made it to 10, you're more likely to make it to 20. If you haven't made it to 10, well, good luck. Try again.
Good luck. Try again. We've seen a decline in divorce rates over the past 30 years, but marriages are still ending in divorce. What are some of the common reasons people are parting ways?
Well, if you think about it, a lot of the reasons is that, you know, there's economic pressures on families nowadays. So having two people work while trying to maintain a mortgage, possibly losing their jobs, and then the impact of having children on top of that. So it's usually not just one thing that is causing it. It's kind of like a combination of a whole bunch of things. And then it ends up being the straw that broke the camel's back.
Laurie, who is the hardest hit financially when couples decide to split?
Look, generally it is mothers with younger children, but both partners are impacted financially. And that's largely due to issues and change in home ownership, issues around superannuation, and then in terms of expenses involved in raising the kids.
I'll just throw a curveball at you, but, you know, we're having this huge debate at the moment about housing affordability and entering the market. Obviously, when couples divorce, you need two houses, not one, and that can't be easy. Is that having any impact on people's decision-making?
Oh, look, I think it is. What we did in this research was undertaken partly by funding through AMP, so we've had an ongoing sort of social series of work. And this year we looked at divorce. And in terms of home ownership, we compared couples who did divorce and couples who remained married. And you're looking sort of in the age, you know, around about your mid-40s. And home ownership in those couples who remain married increased to about 80%. So that's with a mortgage or owned outright. Now, when you divorce, what happened is the rates of home ownership dropped to way below 50. And even after the divorce had sort of been finalised, there was a bit of tracking again towards home ownership, but it still remained significantly below married couples. And some of the increasing re-entry into home ownership is to do with the financial settlement. But there's issues around, well, can we retain the family home? Do we have to downsize? Do we have to stay in rental accommodation? So there's a whole range of issues of you pointing out in terms of where does the family live after they've separated.
The mid-40s, as you say, seems to be a prime time for marriage splits. Is this likely to have then, as people make their future plans, a big impact on retirement planning?
Oh, look, it certainly does, because of your capabilities in terms of savings, either voluntary savings or through compulsory superannuation. And as most of your listeners will know, women typically have much lower rates of superannuation balances. And then when it comes to splitting assets on divorce, even though it's a sort of no-fault divorce in Australia since I think about the 1970s, I always thought there'd be some egalitarian rule in splitting assets when you separate, but it's not the case. You have to negotiate that, and what you have coming into the marriage will count towards what you have when you go out of the marriage. So things like superannuation, when you're a couple, you often think of that as a combined asset. When you split, that then becomes debatable as to who's going to get what in terms of super. And that partly depends on if you're younger, your super balances are much lower. It's a long time in the future before you'll realise that super asset, so it may not be a big issue. But if you're getting divorced when you're in your, you know, late 50s, early 60s, then super becomes a huge issue. And what we found is there's a big difference in super balances held by divorced males and females compared to those who are married.
Amanda, this week, season 4 of the TV series Married at First Sight started. It's kind of a show where two complete strangers marry each other. You could say it's a bit like the equivalent of arranged marriages in certain cultures. I mean, that still exists around the world. I mean, I know my grandmother was forced into an arranged marriage. This does happen. Is there any evidence that suggests couples who don't get married based on romantic love are less likely to get divorced?
Well, this is the interesting thing. It's not necessarily that creates the divorce. It's actually what their level of communication is. So if you have two people, regardless if they're well matched or poorly matched, if they have really great communication, their likelihood of divorce is actually less likely. So really what you're looking at is that you actually want to increase the way that people communicate. And by increasing that communication, they'll have better intimacy and, you know, ends up being a great relationship.
So communication's the key, not the way that the marriage comes about. I mean,
exactly.
How do you even engage people to try and change the way they communicate? Obviously, some people are better at that than others.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely people in this world who are better communicators than others. But what we need to consider is, you know, you've come from two different families, two different cultures, two different backgrounds, whatever it might be. Your tendency to communicate differently is going to be there. So it's one of those things. Go and see a professional. Go and see someone who can help you learn to communicate and set the basis and the foundation for that relationship so that it can move forward.
On RN, I'm Patricia Carvalis, and you're listening to The Drawing Room. I'm speaking tonight to Amanda Lambros and Professor Laurie Brown about divorce trends and the consequences in Australia. I wonder what other trends you're noticing, Amanda, in terms of the way people feel about divorce. I mean, obviously divorce changes culturally as people get more used to it and it becomes more common. Has there been any shifts that you've noted?
I've definitely noticed a shift in that it's become a lot less taboo. So it's not like, oh, you're the divorcee. It's, oh, okay, you've been divorced. Now are you planning on getting remarried or dating again, getting back on the scene? So it's more of a common conversation now as opposed to a hidden fact.
Yeah, I think I've noticed that too. I think it's a very astute observation, actually. It has become more common, I mean, more mainstream and more normalised. So does that have an impact? Does that mean more people will consider divorce because they know that the taboo is not like it used to be?
I think they just might not necessarily consider divorce, but realize that it's not a shunned thing anymore. So that if they're unhappy in their marriage or if it's, you know, a situation that they could actually find happiness somewhere else and, you know, communicate better with their next partner, that's probably something that they feel that they're capable of doing, whereas previously they might not have felt capable of doing it and rather felt trapped in the situation.
So, Amanda, I think lots of people feel unhappy at different points in their relationship. I think it's a fairly common experience. What are the indicators that the unhappiness is so serious or so profound that it deserves divorce? Because, of course, relationships are inherently difficult. I mean, you're with somebody for the rest of your life. That's the commitment. That's incredibly intense.
I think rather than waiting until the issue is extremely present, when it little things start to creep in, so when complacency starts to creep in, that's actually a really good thing to start looking at. Like, why are we sitting on, you know, we're watching TV at night and I'm sitting on the long couch and he's sitting on the short couch and we don't even want to touch each other anymore. It's those kind of things that you really need to, those are like the little red flags. And don't wait till you have 30 red flags. Wait till you have one or two and then go and talk to somebody and say, I really think we need to work on, you know, reconnecting or reuniting and going on a date night and things like that.
Laurie, we spoke about the financial cost of people making that decision to divorce and the fact that it does hit women in a particular way. Single mums become often the hardest hit. Are the financial consequences likely to impact the next generation, the children, the consequence of the divorce, or does it really matter on depend on the way that divorce is managed?
Oh, it does depend on the way the divorce is managed. I mean, there's some pleasing trends, if you like, in terms of the rate of divorce in Australia has actually gone down over the last 20 years. And that's partly accounted for by people getting married slightly later. So the age of males for the first time being married is 30, and for women it's 28. And there's increasing rates of cohabitation. So maybe people are getting to know each other a little bit more before settling down.
Try before you buy.
Yes, exactly. And then when it comes to the kids, what our work has shown is impacts of divorce on the educational outcome of children from divorced parents. And even if you take into account other influences on people's educational outcomes, you know, things like the level of education your parents had, the aspirations within the household, the socioeconomic background, then if you ask young adults, were they living with both parents when they were in their teenage years or living with a divorced parent, and you then look at their educational outcomes, you find kids out of divorced families have a much higher chance of being early school leavers, so they've not completed high school, and have a much lower chance of getting a tertiary education. And even if people repartner, that the step-parent, if you like, doesn't make up for the gap that happened in that sort of break in, I guess we can call it social capital. So the break in the family networks, the family support, even with the best intentions of parents, you can still see some long-term outcomes in terms of the children.
So I wonder what your views are, Amanda, about the sort of the role of the state in all of this, because we've had programs rolled out, you know, for counselling, you know, a program of the Abbott government for some level of counselling for people considering marriage. Does the state have or should they have a role in trying to ensure successful marriages because of the cost ultimately to children and the community, or is it, you know, none of their business? They should keep their nose out of it.
Oh, ideally, it would be wonderful if the state wanted to help out. But, you know, in one of the programs that you're discussing, it's the state provided $200. Well, if a counseling session's $150, great, you've gone to one session. That's not really going to get you through your marriage, you know, so, or even pre-marriage. And so I think it also falls on the couple getting married is, do we want to start this relationship with a really great foundation? And if so, then we need to not only invest in each other, but also invest in a program that can help us with those skills. And so very similar to how you would buy your wedding dress or, you know, get the right venue or whatever it might be, you might want to put a little bit of money aside to make sure that you can start your relationship on the right foundation.
Well, it's been a really fascinating conversation. You know, try before you buy is really my favourite saying. So thank you for allowing me to find a way to say that. Thank you to both of you.
Oh, no worries. You're welcome.
And that's Amanda Lambros. She's a clinical fellow at Curtin University in Western Australia and a relationships counsellor. And also Professor Laurie Brown, who's the director at the National Centre for Social and Economic Modelling, which is, you know, known as NATSEM, at the University of Canberra, both joining me tonight in the drawing room.